The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, Anne Scott James, and Dennis Norden. And here's round one, which does its best to test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words approximately right. We begin with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is an agrimotor?
It's an agricultural motor.
And what would you do with it?
Turn up the fields.
Yes, I think you might. 2 marks, good enough. It's a vehicle or a tractor used for agricultural purposes of different kinds.
A bulldozer is a sleeping pill for bulls.
Now, quite a different one for Dennis Norden. What is the meaning of axillary?
When they were planning the Everest expedition, they put in for something for Sir Edmund to chop wood with for fire. They indented for 1 axillary. Or else it's something anatomical. It's a part of the body.
Yes, it is. Do you know which part?
It's above or below. If it isn't above or below the waist, it's the waist.
No, it's above the waist. Well above the waist.
I don't know. It's something to do with the arms.
Yes. I'll give you 1.5 out of 2, which is fairly generous. It is, in fact, something belonging to the armpit, like the...
Deodorant.
1.5. Anne Scott James, what is a micron? M-I-C-R-O-N.
Well, something very, very small.
Very, very, very small indeed.
Such as a tiny insect or a speck of dust or something even smaller than an electron.
No, I think that's...
It's a millionth of an electron.
That's going a bit far.
It's a word that means even smaller than that.
It's a millionth of an atom.
I'll give you 1.5 again, because it is a millionth, which is the key thing, but it's not as small as all that. It's a millionth of a meter, which certainly
that's
is what I've tried to...
It's a useful measure. Useful measure.
Not very useful most of the time. Frank Miller, what is a bathometer? B-A-T-H-O-M-E-T-E-R. Bathometer.
Bathometer is a... It's a word the scientists use for mother's elbow. Device for testing the temperature of the bathwater. Am I at least warm?
1 out of 2.
Depth.
It's
Why
a
depth?
Spring...
Hang on, depth.
Depth.
My lovely partner says depth.
Depth measure.
Yes, you're right. I think I've got to give you a 2 at the last minute. It's a spring balance for determining the depth of water, and it does it on the spring, so you don't have to pull in the whole of the sounding line, which is a very laborious procedure.
I don't understand, but yes.
Well, before we begin round 2, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then I hope that the 2 women members of the team will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, "Kind hearts are more than coronets." And Anne Scott James with Dennis, yours is, "My work is left behind." And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round 2 is a round of odds and ends, 2 marks for correct answers. Dennis Powell, who precisely was Beelzebub?
Beelzebub was a devil, and he was kind of second in command to Satan in Paradise Lost.
Absolutely dead right, and jolly good. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what were the Christian names of Bottom, Quince, Flute, and Snout in The Midsummer Night's Dream? Bottom, Quince, Flute, and Snout.
It was Nick Bottom.
Yes, that's one.
It's a very good name for somebody who sits on a razor.
Thank you.
Peter Quince.
Yes.
Who else?
Flute and Snout.
Fill the flute. I don't know flute. And I know out about Snout. I didn't know.
Well, it's jolly good so far. One out of two, I'm afraid. Nick Bottom, Peter Quince, Francis Flute, and Tom Snout. Now, Anne Scott James, what were their respective trades? Bottom, Quince, Flute, Snout.
Bottom was a weaver.
Yes.
One of them was a bellows mender.
Yes. Now, which one?
Which is a job you could quietly starve at. Things are getting very slow, so... Yeah.
Just one of them was a tinker.
One of them was a carpenter.
Yes, you've got all three. Now, put them to their right which? Names, and you'll get two marks.
Snout the carpenter.
No.
Oh! Snout was a tinker.
One out.
Quince was a carpenter.
One and a half. You did your awfully well. Mm-hmm. Now, Frank, no, this is quite different again. What was Michelangelo's surname?
Silly Jack, you've given it to me. Angela.
No. He was Michelangelo something.
Oh, dear. Wait a minute. It's coming. I'm not certain, Jack, but was it Duxbury?
I'd love to mark you for that, but I can't. I don't think you're going to get it. He was called Buonarroti.
Oh.
Michelangelo Buonarroti. Next round's about verse and poetry, and what I do is to give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to try and finish it off, the next line or two. Two marks if they can finish the quotation, and two more for correctly naming its source. Let us bow. Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages. Thou thy worldly task hast done, home art gone, and ta'en thy wages.
Lovely, lovely. Beautifully read.
It's Shakespeare.
Yes, Shakespeare, but...
And it's the one about golden lads and lasses must... Like yeah. Something or other come to
like
dust.
Like golden asses come to dust.
Like...
Tom and the Water Babies.
Chimney sweepers.
Yes.
Come to dust.
It's Shakespeare, Cymbeline. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust. Now, Dennis Norden, in a different vein, he thus became immensely rich and built the splendid mansion which is called the Cedars, Muswell Hill, where he resides in affluence still.
It's in jocular vein. It's Hilaire Belloc.
Yes.
And it's one of the cautionary tales. I think it's the one about...
Oh, Charles Augustus Fortescue.
Quite right. Mm. Can you finish it off?
No. I'm not going to mess you about it. Yeah. Let's get home.
All right, three out of four. Hilaire Belloc's cautionary tales, the one that starts, the nicest child I ever knew, and it's about this Charles Augustus Fortescue, but it runs like this. He thus became immensely rich and built the splendid mansion, which is called the Cedars, Muswell Hill, where he resides in affluence still, to show what everybody might become by simply doing right. Anne Scott James. He thought he saw a kangaroo that worked a coffee mill. He looked again and found it was a vegetable pill.
Well, it's certainly Lewis Carroll.
Yes.
And it's Sylvia and Bruno.
Yes, quite right.
No.
Now, can we finish it? Could you say
a vegetable pill? What do you do with a vegetable pill?
Oh, made him very, very ill, I'm sure.
That's right. Were I to swallow this, he said, I should be very ill. Frank Muir, welcome, wild northeaster. Shame it is to see.
Welcome, wild northeaster.
Shame it is to see.
Little Dolly's miniskirt blowing up from thee. What is it?
It's by Kingsley.
It's by Kingsley?
Absolutely right. It's
Charles.
By
Kingsley. Charles Kingsley. Charles Kingsley. Yes. It wasn't Sid. No. We think it's Charles Kingsley, Ode to the East Wind.
Northeast.
Wind.
Yes.
Well, it veered a bit while I was talking. And how's it gone? What are the next two lines, yeah?
I wanted the next two lines if I could.
Oh, you did? Start off again, then.
Two out of four. Charles King's his ode to the northeast wind. That's quite right. Welcome, wild northeaster. Shame it is to see odes to every zephyr, ne'er averse to thee. And there's an awful lot of stuff about Vikings in the end, bracing brain and sinew and whatnot. This next round is the who, why, and what department. 2 marks for correct answers. Now, Dennis Power, in what play by what author did what character say, comparisons are odorous?
It's Shakespeare, and it's a comic character.
Comic policeman.
Comic policeman, it's...
Dogberry.
Yes,
Dogberry.
That's it.
Dogberry and...
Dogberry in...
Is it Allswell?
No, nearly that.
Which one?
It's Dogberry.
Yeah.
In Much Ado About Nothing by Shakespeare, and Dogberry says to Verges, comparisons are odorous. 1 out of 2. Now, Dennis Norden, what is the meaning of esoteric and why?
Esoteric means possessed of specialized knowledge,
yeah,
which isn't available to the majority.
That's right, yes.
But I should think it was one of the Greek philosophic sects, wasn't it? Who,
yes,
sort of had their own specialised... Not sophist, is it?
Not sophism, but you're getting most of the word.
I don't think we should go on and
I'll
on
give
about
you one and
sects
a half.
On this.
I'll give you 1.5 out of 2. It means, esoteric means something meant for the initiated, for the inner circle of disciples, and therefore it can mean private or confidential. But it was Pythagoras who gave lectures in a rather specially shy way, because he stood behind a curtain, and only the most favoured disciples were allowed in behind the curtain, and they were the esoteric disciples. All the rest had to stand outside and pick up what they could, and they were the exoteric disciples.
Prove it.
Now, Anne Scott James, what is a hudibrastic rhyme, and why is it so called?
Well, it must be the sort of rhyme which was invented in Hudibras.
Yes.
By Mr. Butler.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the nature of the rhyme?
Well,
Dennis?
It's a sort of difficult rhyme.
Yeah.
It's a rhyme you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
You know that song, Put on a Happy Face? It's got a bit in the middle that goes, take off that mask of tragedy, it's not worthwhile, and then you'll find your gladgedy sided to smile.
It's absolutely right.
That's hudibrastic.
Yes, absolutely right. 2 marks it is. Now, Frank Muir, in what book, and I don't mean the song, would you find a character named Tom Bowling?
Isn't it in Smollett?
Yes, quite right. Which book?
Roderick Random.
Yes, that's right. And it's a bit much to expect. Yeah, well done. Bit much to expect you to know what this character actually was.
He wasn't the bosun, was he?
Now, well, good enough. 2 marks I'll give you. Tom Bowling was the model sailor in Smollett's novel, Roderick Random. But the song was written later, and Tom Bowling was Captain Thomas Dibdin, the brother of Charles Dibdin, who wrote the song, and he must have got it out of Smollett's book. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. And Dennis Powell, for 2 marks, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Kind hearts are more than coronets.
And simple faith than Norman blood.
Yes.
Tennyson.
Yes. Remember the poem?
No iron bars, a cage.
Lady something.
Yes.
Yeah, or something.
Yes, that's
like
right.
That
yes.
Lady
it's Tennyson's Lady Clara Vere de Vere, who was the most appalling snob. And it's kind hearts are more than coronets and simple faith than Norman blood. 2 marks. Now, Anne Scott James, please can I have the origin of your quotation, which was, my work is left behind.
Hilaire Belloc.
Mm-hmm. Remember the name of the poem?
The South Country.
Yes, well done. 2 marks it is. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir and his quotation, kind hearts are more than coronets.
This is All I claim for this story is that it is substantially true and explains why, when I returned my family from our little medieval slum in Corsica about a month ago, why my relatives and close friends noticed a change in my appearance. I had a tonsure. I had no hair on the top of my head, and it was apparently shaved, and just a sort of ring of hair around it. It came about, you see, because there we were. We'd been at our little place for 3 weeks, and we'd never yet found where the village dustbin is. And we had all this cardboard boxes full of old grape pips and gum boots and things, what to do with them. So the only thing was to pile into the car and drive off up to the mountains and chuck them out of the car window, you see. So we set off early morning, reckoning we'd be back on the beach by about 10. But every time we rounded a bend, there was either a sheep looking at us, or a shepherd, or a passing car. And by nightfall, we were well into the mountains. And we stopped at a place called Corte, which is the ancient capital of Corsica. And we booked into a hotel room, which is very nice. And it was very hot. It was summer. But there was one of those nice big electric fans which go around slowly, such as they have in Shanghai. But it's all right. Although I'm very tall, it missed me by a clear inch. I took the family out to find some food, and we came across a Chinese restaurant. All this business is absolutely true. A Chinese restaurant stuck in this village, one street, large village in Corsica, the ancient capital. We went in and we sat down, and the proprietor, a man of Eastern aspect, was sitting watching the telly. Which is rather peculiar, because the reception wasn't very good in the mountains of Corsica, and it did that thing where it looked as though you're in a lift passing a succession of floors. He was glued to this, and we sat there for a while. Then Madame appeared in full Eastern dress and very reluctantly gave us a menu, and the menu had 5 items of Chinese food. And anyone who knows Chinese restaurants will appreciate that there are at least 90 items in any Chinese. This had 5. And it started off with tinned hearts of palm trees, which my wife likes very, very much, because she comes from Mauritius and she had them as a child and whatnot. And they were 5 francs, which is 7 and 6. And I said, no, we can't spend that. There are 4 of us, 20 francs, we can't afford it. We'd have to have something cheaper. And the only other thing cheaper was beefsteak a la curry. So we called Madam and we ordered the beefsteak. After about 10 minutes, the meat arrived and was sat down. And it had a sort of curry, bits of curry daubed all over it. But it was basically a lump of Cornish beefsteak, than which the soles of old army boots are as patty de foie gras. We managed to cut it up. They were quite large steaks, and we started chewing them. Well, there's no possibility of swallowing this. The only hope at 3 francs per portion was to chew and extract some of the juice and get some kind of sustenance. Then another logistic problem arose. What to do with what's left of the mouthful when you've chewed it? Because the odd thing about quite a small piece of tough beefsteak is when you've chewed it for about 9 minutes, it's 4 times the size. We didn't want to offend these kind people and upset him watching the television, so we squeezed it by the side of our plates. It grew to monumental proportions, and there were 4 of us. So what I did was, quite sensibly, I collected all these bits of chewed meat. I was wearing sandals at the time. I unstrapped the sandals, latched them onto the last hole, pressed them into the sandals, and then put my feet in. It made me a little taller, mark you. When I got to the hotel, I thought I would empty them. So I raced into the hotel room, ran in. Now, you remember me telling you about this electric fan which is going round? And you remember me telling you that it was all right, because though I was tall, it was an inch above my head. Well, the actual amount of chewed steak I was wearing underneath my socks was 1 1/4 inches. And so my head struck the electric fan blades and the top of my head, my hair was cut off, and I came home with a tonsure, and all because it was, I was too mean to buy my wife and children the food they wanted. This tinned hearts of palm rather than this dreadful meat with a curry on. So, really, that's really the whole story as told in Lady Clara Vere de Vere. That do remember, and I shall always remember, that if you're in Corsica and you want to eat, even though it's more expensive, do have the Chinese food, even though canned hearts are more than curried meats.
And now we go on to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his quotation was, "My work is left behind."
Somebody once said that middle age is the time of life when the narrow waist and the broad mind begin to change places. Now, I can vouch for this because half of it already has started to happen to me. I'm beginning to put on weight. It was born forcibly upon me, this fact, last Tuesday when I happened to be going through the attic. And in the attic, I saw my old RAF uniform. And there it was, you know, with the tear stains and everything. And I thought, I'll try it on. And I did. And it was shattering. Now, the only bit of it that fitted me was the tie. You know, which is, it was a dreadful thing because I've always kind of thought of myself as being like the greyhound type, you know. And in fact, on my passport, you know, where it says physical characteristics, I had written down tall, slim, lithe, you know. The last time I went through, the immigrant officer looked at my waistline and said, "It certainly is." But it was this experience with the uniform. And I went downstairs and I stood sideways in front of a mirror and looked at myself. And sure enough, when I breathed out, I was like a full hot water bottle. You know, I've got to lose some weight. Now, whenever you decide that, people sort of flock with their advice. Everybody loves to advise other people how to go on a diet, you know. Oh, you've got to take up golf. I hate golf. I think there's something that is psychologically wrong with a game where the person who hits the ball the most loses. And then somebody said something quite interesting. He said, "Try sauna bath." I don't know if you've ever seen these sauna baths. It's a habit that's come over here from Finland. So it was sort of finished before it started. it's a little sort of wood-lined room. It's like a hot telephone box, you know. And I went in there, and it really is quite fascinating because after about 3 minutes, I was absolutely dripping, you know, and another bloke in there, and I said to him, it's marvellous, isn't it? And he said, "Is it your first time?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Can I give you a tip?" So I said, "Yes." He said, "You're supposed to take your clothes off." So I went out to this changing room that they have, and I took all my clothes off, and I came back and sat down again and shot up about 8 foot in the air. You know, because you sit on these wooden slats, which are also at a temperature of 110 degrees. You know. It's all about fire down below. You know. And I noticed that the other people in there, they all knew about it. They were sitting on towels. You see, well, I hadn't thought to bring a towel, so out I went again, and I searched through my clothes, and the only thing I found was a sheet of paper with some writing I'd been doing. I was, at that time, engaged on ghost writing for somebody I knew called My Life with 11 Different Men. It's interesting, actually. It's the autobiography of a football team manager. It was It was the only thing I had, you see. So I took that in, spread that on the slats, you know, and sat on that. Now, I'll tell you something rather interesting, which you may not know, about typewriter ink. At a temperature of 110 degrees, it undergoes a sort of chemical change. It transfers itself. So that when I got up, the piece of paper was blank. But on the left-hand side of my body, on the part which the Victorians called the lower back, I had imprinted a true confession. And it was because of this that when I went along to the editor and handed him this blank sheet of paper, and he said, "Where is the synopsis then?" I was then able to answer with only a very slight transposition of that snappy line of Hilaire Belloc's. I said, "My work is behind left."
By your vote, Dennis Norden wins the contest of the two stories, and therefore his team win this entire game by one mark. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason, and presented by the BBC. ¶¶